Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to XYZ, the podcast about CNC automation, robotics, business, and more. My name is Nick Frank. I'm one of the owners at Frank Brothers Guitar Company, and I'm joined by my good pal and co-host, Aaron Goff of Goff Custom Knives. How the hell are you?
Good, man. It's good to see your face again.
Yeah, likewise. I mean, this is radio, so it's good to hear your voice.
There you go. Yeah, my apologies to everyone that was very angry. I got lots of very angry messages, people being like, where the hell are you, etc.
Nobody reached out to me at all.
It was nice that people missed us. Yeah, I'm sorry that we weren't recording for a while there. I was just feeling very, like, you ever feel like you just have commitments every second of every day and you just want to turn them all off for a little bit?
Yeah, I've got a lot of commitments, so I kind of know the feeling.
Yeah, so I was just like, okay, I need a little bit of a mental health break here for a little bit. So I there's a lot of stuff I can't avoid, but I just turned off all the stuff I could avoid for a couple of weeks there.
Fair enough. Yeah. We're back at it now, though.
Yes, sir. How are you, mate? How are things with you?
Good. I feel like, you know, I don't know how long it's been because time just, you know, is that abstract?
It's been 3 weeks.
Oh, okay. So yeah, I've been good. I mean, we've just been like totally swamped with production, which is my favorite place to be. Cause when you're totally swamped with production, you kind of don't, it gives you perspective on how production is going. So you think about the processes or, you know, how you can make things more efficient, but the other stuff that kind of nags at you when you run a business kind of, you don't think about for a while. It's probably not great, but it'll catch up with me. But that's where I've been. I've been enjoying that, that aspect of the heavy production.
Nice.
Cause sometimes production's slow, you know, but that's, you know, I find that a slog.
Has it been speedy now with the new processes and stuff?
Or? Man, like the Haas just cooks. That's my
It's not much of a comparison between something like the Haas and a router, right?
No, I mean, the other big thing about it, like tool changes are faster, sure. Rapids are faster. It's really the way we've set the Haas up, the work holding, how we, you know, putting parts on, taking parts off. We've updated the code for the machine, like for the Haas versus, you know, because we were making the same stuff on the axes. It's just we've improved all those lessons we learned from the axes. We could have applied to that machine too, but we also just have less rework. Like the tolerances are better. I don't have to worry so much about the calibration of it.
Right. Yeah, and plus you can keep a lot of tools in the machine.
That's the best part. Oh my god, I'm saving so much time on my tool changes, tool swaps, like swapping out tools for like running fretboards, and then I've got to run plastics, and now I've got to run bodies, like, and I'm still doing that because I still run fretboards, I still run necks, and I have been running plastics up until this up next week. I'll be not running plastics on the axes anymore, except for specialty stuff.
Awesome.
So I think probably in that respect, a lot's changed in the last few weeks. Just in that, awesome. I've been using the Haas a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had some crazy, like, typical things happen in terms of that, you know, have held us back.
Like what? Give us an example of one. You said crazy.
Ooh, okay. I had a super scary near crash.
Oh, on the Haas or on the axis?
Yeah. on the Haas. I did crash the axes too, but that's neither here nor there. yeah, this was fucked up. And it was kind of my fault, kind of not my fault. So, and it kind of doesn't make any sense. So here's what happened. I started running a program. I forget what I was even doing, but I got like halfway through the program and I was like, and I needed to pause it, to stop it. I remember what I was doing. We glued a top to a guitar and we needed to take the top off. So I was going to rerun the top routing program.
Just cut it all the way.
Just cut it right off. But I had to skip a couple program parts because that program also routes the holes for the bushings, the hardened steel bushings for locating. So I didn't want to route those out and I didn't want to remove them. So I was like, oh, I'll just skip ahead in the program. And Haas has a thing called setting 36. Or it's program restart. And you can skip ahead to a line of code and press start. And it'll, you know, run through the code in the computer, but not actually run the code. And then start right there. And usually it does like a tool change. Even if it's got the right tool in it, it'll change the tool and then change back. I don't know why. So what you have to do is turn setting 36 on. And I thought we just had it on. For some reason, I just thought it was on because we'd done this recently. And it works. It's easy to use.
Right.
So I went to the line of code, selected it, pressed start, and the spindle just plunged straight down all the way, bottomed itself out.
Like, was that a cutting? Was that in the program?
No, not even, it's that not, move? That's not even a movement that's in the program at all.
Oh.
It plunged straight down, which we would never do because we have a fixture plate and a pallet, you know, like a, we've got a, what am I trying to say? We have our pallets on top of a fixture.
That's gross.
Another fixture plate.
Did you work out why it happened?
Well, I mean, so I didn't have setting 36 on, which is what happened when I called Haas. I complained. I was like, this just happened. It was crazy. So first of all, luckily, my table was all the way forward because when the program ends, it moves the table all the way forward to the operator, presents home itself.
Position. Yeah.
So it that's where our home is, kind of. So it literally just missed. The spindle missed the table by like a quarter of an inch.
So what things did you learn from this?
Sorry?
What things did you learn from this?
Well, have setting 36 on, I guess, but that's not fair. Like that shouldn't happen. Even if, because you could say, you know, this is a touch screen. I could touch the screen by mistake and highlight a certain line of code and press cycle start without even thinking or, you know, knowing I did it. That's an easy mistake to make. And what is it, just going to plunge the spindle down?
It's really strange that it made that move, even though that move isn't in the program anyway.
Exactly.
Like, was it doing something because you didn't have a tool offset set or something?
You know, not to my knowledge.
Yeah. For me, whenever I'm doing something that's even slightly out of the usual, in my head, the process is always rapids to minimum, so 25% in my case, and feed rate down, you know, so I turn the feed rate down to like 10% or whatever. And then, you know, as things are good, I start turning it back up to 100%.
That's smart.
I turn the rapids back up. Whenever you're doing something out of the ordinary, there's always the possibility for something unexpected to happen, you know, and as you found out, it's brown trousers time when it does.
It was fucked up.
Yeah,
I was like, I literally stood there and just like wiped the sweat from my brow and like breathed deeply for like 5 minutes and just stared at it because it was like shocking and super lucky. So it would have been a bad crash because it was like full rapids, plunge, Zed, right down. You know?
Yeah, I've actually done that exact same thing, but made contact.
Oh.
Yeah, I forget what the issue was. I think I hadn't set up a tool offset correctly, And so the machine went to start the program, and it just smashed the front of the tool holder straight into the side of the fixture, which luckily the fixture was held in the vise and it was sticking out on the left-hand side. So rather than making solid contact, it actually like tore it out of the vise jaws upwards. It like pivoted the fixture. So that slowed it down and overloaded this servo without like crashing into an immovable surface like my vise.
Right, it was like an airbag.
Yeah, but it's still like it's friction stir welded the collet nut into the side of the fixture, threw sparks out in a big like 360 degrees. You know, I was like,
oh, fuck. Sweet,
yeah, brown trousers time, as I said.
Yeah.
And that's why I do 25% rapids and 10% feed.
Well,
now.
I haven't had the guts to try using program restart since, but I don't think that's, I think that's a fuck up on the machine's part, to be honest.
Yeah. So the other thing that I do to mitigate issues like that is rather than using program restart, I actually repost my code with just the operations I want to do from Fusion 360. So if in Fusion, you know, when you're posting an entire program, you'll like click the setup and then say post, but you can actually go through and pick, if you hold down command and click on individual operations, like individual toolpaths, you can post just part of a program. So if I need to rework or do something where I'm just doing part of a program, I actually just repost to avoid.
And that's what we ended up doing.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's a function that they offer, and it should be usable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't have it on, so my bad. But that's not the punishment I should be getting for.
Yeah,
for making that kind of mistake, like that's
100%.
The machine's just going to destroy itself now because you forgot to turn one setting on.
Yeah,
seriously. I don't know. Come at me if you are listening and you have an opinion about it. But when I talked to Haas about it, they were like, you know, I like to be honest. I'm like, I wasn't going to tell them that I didn't make a mistake. Like, this is what happened exactly. And they were like, oh, well, you have to have setting 36 on. I'm like, yes, I know that. But is that really what happens when you don't have setting 36 on?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that seems fucked up. That shouldn't happen, you know?
Yeah.
Anyways, so there was that. what about you?
Oh, glad you missed. Yeah, unfortunately, I'm still catching up. I'm still like working on catching up with production stuff, and for the most part that was going pretty smoothly, but I was just feeling really overworked. And then this week, like the last 7 days, I may as well have you seen that have you seen the movie Idiocracy?
I don't know.
So there's a TV. So it's this movie about a guy that gets frozen, and then he wakes up and all the stupid people have been breeding, and the whole world is full of morons. And like, if the most popular TV show in this world is called Ow My Balls. And it's just the same guy getting hit in the nuts over and over again.
Yeah, that's
and yeah, the last week has felt a little bit like that.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, walk me through it, 'cause I've seen a little bit on your Instagram story.
Yeah, so like on Friday or Thursday evening, I was cutting some G10 on my Fidal, on Millie, the VMC10, and I heard this really nasty like rattling noise, and I was like, okay, what was that? So I hit stop, and it was right at the end of the day, so I was like, okay, I'll peace out, and I'll come back tomorrow and see what happened. So I come in, and I pull the head of the machine apart, and it was something that was happening like with the spindle, like it was happening in time with the RPM and the spindle. It was like a rattle or something. I took everything apart, looked at the belts, you know, checked everything out. I couldn't see anything bad. I put it all back together and tried to make it make the noise again, and I couldn't. So I was like, oh, I must have fixed it. You know, sometimes you just get a rattle or something.
Bolts or something.
Yeah, who knows. And then, you know, I was using it, it was fine. And then I came in on Monday and I started the machine up, and same noise, but much worse. Like, it sounded like someone had thrown a handful of gravel into my spindle motor is what it sounds like. So yeah, I mean, it sounded very much like it was coming from the spindle motor. So I was like, all right, well, as far as I know, that's the original spindle motor on that machine. So, you know, probably a bad bearing. So I pulled it out. I pulled the spindle motor, started pulling the motor apart. Honestly, like, not a big deal at all. You know, like, replacing the bearings in a motor is actually easier than I had thought, which is great. Ordered the bearings on McMaster. Gotta love McMaster. And last time I ordered something from McMaster, they said it was going to be delivered like 2 to 4 p.m. And then they tried to deliver it at like 9:30 in the morning and I wasn't there and I missed it. So Tuesday, I'm like, okay, I can't miss this delivery. So I get to the shop early and I'm sitting around. And then I end up sitting around all day because it doesn't come until 3 p.m.
Okay. Like they said.
That's, yeah, no big deal. And then I'd ordered a gear puller as well because I didn't have a gear puller big enough to pull off the front bearing, because the front bearing on the spindle motor is actually about 6 inches from the end of the shaft. So you'd need a really big bearing puller to get it. Huh. So, you know, that nothing terrible, like, you know, things happen. But I'm sitting there and my whole shop is a disaster. I can't really work on anything else because I've like pulled the compressor out, the shop crane's in the way, you know, the machine's pulled apart, blah, blah. So I'm just like kind of taking it easy. I'm sitting there and I'm looking at this dent that's on the front left-hand side of the screen of my MacBook. And I'm like, I should just push that dent out. It's been there forever. So I get like a bit of plastic and I start pushing it. And then the screen blacks out. I'm like, oh my God. You ever have one of those moments where you're in the middle of doing something and you're like, this is a bad idea. Why am I doing this? Yeah. And yeah, so the glass on the screen must have been just chipped, and that little bit of pressure, it just started cracking, and then the crack just destroyed the LCD screen. I just killed my MacBook because I was bored, basically. So then I was like, I can't like not have a computer. That's like how my business runs, you know? So I spent the rest of the day, I found a guy that was selling another computer, another identical computer. I just went and bought it. It was like $700, $750. But then it turns out that one had a swollen battery when I like took it apart to check it out. So I ended up swapping the screen onto my one instead. So that was like Tuesday done.
So and then today, paid for a screen, bought a screen.
Oh yeah, bought a whole computer for a screen. Yeah, seriously. And then yeah, I bought another bearing puller, and that arrived at like 4 p.m. on Tuesday, but and it still wasn't long enough. They really? Said this, the listing for this thing said, you know, it had an 8-inch reach, but I measured it. That 8-inch reach is when the jaws are at zero width, like right, they're all the way together. So, and as soon as you spread them out, the reach reduces substantially. Yeah. So I was fucking around with it this morning. I was like welding lugs onto the outer race of the bearing so that I could like get to, I could pull it from the front side of the bearing where I could actually reach all this crap. And like the bearing was on there so hard that I actually welded on 3/16 thick steel flat stock onto the outside race of the bearing. And then I was putting so much pressure on the puller that the steel that I'd welded on just flowed like candy. Like it just bent right over, even though it was like only sticking out like a quarter of an inch. Yeah, it's pretty crazy. So in the end, I was like, you know what? There's an automotive, like there's like a mechanics shop in the building that I'm in. So I went in there and I was like, do you guys have like a press or something? Can I pay you like $50 to like press this off? And the owner was like, oh yeah, he's running around. But yeah, he did it in like 5 minutes and then he wouldn't take my money. You know? So I spent like 3 hours fucking around with this thing when I should have just gone and asked someone that had the right tools, you know?
Well, so do it yourselfer.
Yeah. Well, I like to have the tools on hand to do all that kind of stuff, you know, if you need to. So, yeah, a small hydraulic press is now on my shopping list. but yeah, so the motor's all back together.
How much is a new bearing? Like,
oh, it wasn't much at all. It was like $70 for both the top and bottom bearings.
Wow. Okay. And that was the problem?
We'll see. I mean, the inside of the bearing race did have some wear. And there was some slop in it, but it's kind of hard to tell with this kind of bearing because it's not like an angular contact bearing. It's what's called a deep groove ball bearing. So there's always some slop in them. Like, okay. You know, when they're new from the factory, that you can kind of wiggle a shaft that's in one of those bearings.
Okay.
It's not designed. It's designed to constrain the shaft radially, not axially. So it has to have some play in it. So yeah, I'll really only know once I put it back in the machine.
Well, I hope that's it.
Yeah, me too.
What else could it be? Crossed.
Spindle bearings.
Ooh, that's a whole other story, eh?
Yes. Yeah, I don't want it to be the spindle bearings. So, fingers crossed that it's fixed.
What would be involved in replacing the spindle bearings? Replacing the whole spindle?
Yes. So, the spindle bearings, you can rebuild a spindle yourself. The problem is that in order to inspect the bearings, you have to like press them off the spindle. And once you've done that, you've basically destroyed the bearings anyway.
Right.
So, and just a set of bearings for the Fidal, the bearings in a spindle are like really high precision, right? So a set of angular contact bearings for the spindle in a Fidal is about $1,000 US.
Not from McMaster.
I haven't looked it up. You might actually be able to get them on there. The problem is none of the suppliers will tell you what the bearings are. They'll just sell you the bearings. You know,
they do have angular contact thrust bearings, just so you know.
Yeah, I bet they do. But are they C7, like ABEX 7 rated? That's the issue. And normally they have to come in matched pairs as well. So yeah, they're kind of
my research kind of is not telling me that.
yeah, and then the other issue is when you're, so let's say you do manage to pull apart the spindle, change the bearings, and that's the only issue. The other problem is that you have to set the preload correctly. Too much and the spindle will overheat and cook itself again straight away. Too little and the spindle shaft will bounce around inside the housing and you'll get terrible finishes.
Right.
Okay. And when you're assembling the spindle bearings, they don't come greased. You have to add a very precise weighed amount. Like you have to like weigh the grease on like a precision scale to add exactly the right amount. Because again, too much and the bearings will overheat, too little and they'll wear themselves out. And you have to do that in basically a clean room. Because if you get any dust or grit in there, Then that grit's just going to get stirred through your spindle bearings at 7,500 RPM or 10,000 RPM. And again, your new spindle bearings are toast. So yeah, doing a spindle rebuild in-house is one of those things that's like, yeah, it's totally possible to do it, but you have to be like very careful.
Right. So maybe not worth it if you're going to have to drop $1,000. How much is a new spindle?
Like $3,500.
Okay.
Well, but you could send one out. You could send it out and have it rebuilt. Like another company will rebuild it for you for, you know, $1,500.
Right.
So that would be the smarter thing to do.
Right. Well, yeah, let's hope that's not it.
Yeah, exactly. Let's hope it's the $70 worth of spindle bearings.
So where spindle are you motor at right bearing. Now? Right. Where are you at?
I just shrink fitted the pulley back onto the motor.
Cool.
So the motor is ready to be lifted back into place and wired back in. I did notice that I did a balance on the motor pulley the other day, because I was thinking like, oh, maybe it's the vibration, you know, maybe the motor pulley wasn't balanced properly. And I noticed that I actually added weights. I didn't realize the pulley had already been balanced previously. And so when I was like refitting it, I pulled out all the little cork stoppers that cover the balancing holes. And I noticed that they were actually weights added at the factory exactly opposite of the weights that I added. So clearly the factory balance was wrong because really? I was like undoing their balance. Yeah. So I'll have to, do that again, after I've fitted it. No, that's fine. That's not a huge deal.
So when are you going to fire it up and see?
Tomorrow morning. I'll put it back together tomorrow morning. Do the balance on the spindle motor and the spindle motor pulley, and then belt her up and see what happens.
Alrighty.
Fingers crossed, eh?
Yes. I'll keep my fingers crossed all day tomorrow for you.
Sounds good. Yeah, apart from that, I've been working on automated finishing in the machines, which is fun and exciting.
More brushes?
Yes, more brushes. And I've actually found some that work, which is very funny. And guess how much they are. So the last brushes that I've bought, the ZBEC brushes, one brush and its holder was $500.
Okay. I'm going to say $1.50 for a toilet brush from Amazon.
Close. How much do you really think the working brushes are?
Well, okay, so it's a, is it a, you know, precision tool? Like, is it from a, you know,
like it's from McMaster. Commercial?
It's from McMaster. Yeah. I don't know. It's for putting into a spindle? Or have you hacked something together?
Yes. No, it is designed for this.
Okay. I can say $80, the price of a good, you know, end mill.
$7.
How much?
$7.
$7?
Yeah. So it turns out that 3M, who make a lot of abrasives, have this product called a bristle disc.
Bristle disc?
It's actually a bristle disc. And it's actually super cool. It's
okay.
It's an injection molded plastic brush that has a quick, it has like a thread on the back of it. So it actually just like threads into a holder. So they sell like a specific shank for it. That's like, I think it's like $14 for the shank. And then the disc itself is $7. And so, as I said, it's an injection molded plastic brush, but the plastic actually has abrasive in it.
When nylon bristles.
It. Yeah.
Oh, cool. I'm looking at it right now.
So the reason it's super cool, though, is that there's something weird about the geometry of the bristles. With a normal, like, nylon brush that's been kind of, like, they make, like, you know, nylon bristles, and then they kind of cast it together into a brush. When you push one of those into the workpiece, the bristles will spread apart. Does that make sense, right? Like, you're pushing it in, the bristles kind of spread apart, you know? For some reason, these 3M bristle discs, what actually happens is they kind of drag on the surface and they pull together into a more solid piece. So the harder you push them into the workpiece, the more they kind of tuck together and become more solid.
Sure.
Whereas with the other brushes, the more they flatten into the workpiece, the more they flatten out and it kind of gets rid of the pressure that you're trying to create.
Yeah.
So yeah, like where a nylon brush doesn't really cut on, you know, so I'm trying to finish hardened steel, you know, by rubbing a brush over the surface, and the nylon brush just kind of bounces off, doesn't really do anything. These little bristle discs actually cut.
They've got an abrasive in them. It says here, I clicked on it and they got rid of the description. It says that, they've got 3M Rolock?
Yes. Okay, it's 3M Rolock.
There's a grit. Yeah, aluminum oxide.
Yeah.
Grit. So it's basically sandpaper.
Yeah. So, like, it's not perfect, but I'm still experimenting with it. But, you know, for, like, $7, like, if you were going to do deburring, for instance, in the machine, like, if you were machining steel and you wanted to deburr the edges with a brush or something, these are a fantastic option, you know, less expensive than the other brushes that I've tried. And you can change them out in the machine without having to like take out the tool holder or anything.
Right.
So yeah.
That's so cool. And the max RPM is 30,000 for this one.
Yeah. Cause they're designed to be run in like angle grinders and stuff.
Right.
They're not designed for CNC machines.
Okay. Because McMaster sells one that is designed for CNCs. It's ceramic abrasive.
They sell a Rolock, a bristle disc that's designed for CNCs? Or it looks different?
It looks different than the one you use, but it's kind of interesting looking. Did you not see this? If you search
bristle disc. I've seen some, yeah.
Kind of looks like a flower petal pattern.
Yes. Yeah, I think I've seen that.
Okay. But it's much more expensive.
Yeah, and it's that it's not that injection molded. I see that. Yeah, it's not the injection molded bristles. It's the kind of standard nylon fiber bristles. I don't think I've tried that specific one, but I've tried the smaller version of that thing.
Mm. Well, that's cool. So what kind of finish is this leaving you with?
And it's like a swirly sanded finish. You know, it kind of looks like almost like an orbital sander kind of finish.
Okay. And what kind of pattern are you doing? Are you just going over it back and forth, or are you trying to?
I'm doing like a pocketing pattern. So kind of following the outside contours.
Right.
Because one thing I learned pretty quick is that you don't want to cross the boundary of that pocket, you know, because I'm basically machining a pocket into the steel that has like sharp edges,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you cross the brush over that boundary a lot, then you're kind of just wearing it out on the sharp corner of the pocket. Whereas if you kind of keep it in the pocket and you know, go around the shape of the knife stepping inward, then you're not wasting the abrasive, you know? But yeah, I've been super impressed so far. We'll see. We'll see. I mean, I'm not sure that it's going to be a magical solution, but it might help.
Okay? It's going to maybe reduce your downstream processes.
Yes. That's the hope. The other thing is I did actually find that same attachment mechanism, the Rolock TR, which is like this little kind of threaded quick change fastener thing, they actually sell Scotch-Brite pads for that system. Okay. And they sell some that are like super cushioned. They're like 3/8 of an inch thick. So it's like a cushiony sponge, you know. So I actually tried some of those. I haven't tried them in the CNC machine. I've tried them by hand. Mm-hmm. And they're even more aggressive.
Yeah, I'm always impressed by how effective Scotch-Brite is.
Yeah, yeah. Well, like I've got some Scotch-Brite belts for my belt grinder. Right. And the coarser ones will like throw a huge shower of sparks and like take a lot of material off if you're cutting like soft steel.
Yeah, like I've seen people use them to remove tabs on, you know, like 5-axis machine parts, and it's just like boom, gone.
Man, that seems like such a dichotomy, like beautiful 5-axis part, and then you just wham, shove it on the Scotch-Brite.
Yeah, but it's one and done.
Yeah, I guess as long as it's not a dimensioned surface, then you.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. It is funny.
So yeah, I've been working a lot of different stuff. I've also been doing in-process deburring. So that's one thing that I've kind of done manually for a long time is like, you know, I'm like interpolating holes in hard steel, and then running a reamer through them. And so they end up with like a little tiny burr top and bottom. And I'm just kind of like lapping it on a surface plate really quick, but before I change it over to the next station on my fixtures. But I'm trying to like look at, you know, with fresh eyes, all these little things. And now that I'm running lights out, cycle time is a bit less important. So, you know, adding 5 minutes to a cycle to do deburring in the machine, less of an issue.
Yeah.
So I've actually been having fun. I had a lot of fun programming this. It was a bit pucker inducing. I'm actually reaching through these 1/8 holes with a undercutting lollipop.
And so cool. I love
and
that.
Deburring. Yeah, deburring the underside of those holes and also deburring the underside of all the pockets that I'm doing in that same setup. So I think it's about 2.5 minutes of just deburring. But then it comes out with this beautiful tiny little chamfer top and bottom on all of the hard milled pockets and the holes.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I love when everything has products look so much more finished when they've got these machined chamfers and things like that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just tiny, and it's in a place where no one will ever see it because it's sealed inside the handle scales.
Oh, okay. Still nice.
Yeah. It just reduces my, like the amount of attention that I have to pay by a little bit, you know.
I'm trying to remember this tool I saw recently that was so cool. It was a deburring tool, mm-hmm. and it kind of looks like a boring bar almost, and it's got this little tab coming off the side, and as you plunge it into the hole, that is a chamfering tool, but it's spring-loaded. So as you push the tool through the hole, it's chamfering the hole, but at, it's sort of springing into the bar.
Yep.
And then you plunge through, and then it springs out the other side and chamfers the underside of the hole. And then it'll spring right back through. Have you seen this?
Yeah, I have seen it. I'm just trying to find the supplier right now. Yeah, they're super cool. It's made by Cogsdill.
Oh, okay. I've heard of this. I was looking at a different brand, like a Swiss made tool, but I've heard of those as that brand as well.
Yeah. So, where is it? Deburring tools. Yeah. The ones that I've seen are made by Cogsdill, and yeah, they're exactly like that. They have like a little, kind of little tab sticking out that's spring loaded, and then you just feed them in and out through the hole and you've done deburred on both sides. Yeah. Very cool.
So sick.
Yeah.
Huel.
Huel. How do you spell that?
H-E-U-L-E.
H-E-U-L-E. H-E-U-L-E.
Huel Tool.
Huel Tool. Cool. I'll have to check them out.
Yeah, they...
those look fancy.
Yeah, well, they're Swiss.
I actually... So one of the things I've been mucking around with since the last time we talked is my tool holding. So I think we talked about that I was using those hydraulic holders, and I'd found that it just wasn't quite working for my application. So I went back to ER25, which I've used for a long time. And I've been mucking around with using bearing nuts. Rather than the normal plain solid nuts. So the bearing nuts actually have the face that contacts the front of the collet is actually, it has a ball bearing in there. So it can, that section of the nut can rotate. So it means it twists your collet less, which gives you a bit more accuracy.
Okay.
And there's less friction happening when you're tightening the collet. So that means you get more clamping force. So theoretically it's better concentricity, I'm saying that right, and better clamping force. And
but you still use an ER damping collet.
Yeah, you still use the standard ER collet and everything. Yeah.
So isn't there a limit on how much force you should press on an ER collet? Like,
yeah, yeah, and that force though is not really about the collet, as far as I understand it. It's more about the torque that the nut can take.
Oh, okay. Because it's a threaded thing, and
so over tension. So.
Yeah.
So one interesting thing that I've found though so far is that the bearing nuts are less prone to getting scratched and to less prone to fucking up collets, because with a normal collet nut, if there's any contamination inside that face, those two precision surfaces are just like scraping against each other.
Right.
Whereas with a bearing nut, those two faces don't scrape against each other because the nut isn't having to turn that face.
Yeah, I need to see one of these. Where did you get it?
Maritool. They sell bearing nuts as an add-on for their tool holders. So got a couple of those. And then I've also just been doing a super ghetto solution of I bought a quarter-inch hole punch, and I've been hole punching quarter-inch holes in masking tape and then putting that over my tools to seal off the front of the collet. And it works
there
great.
You go. I mean, okay, I found these. What's the set screw for?
The set screw just, what does it do? I think it just retains the bearing balls.
Oh, okay.
Like, and you don't do anything with the set screw.
Do you have I forget if we've talked about this. Do you have a torque wrench?
I do, yes.
And however, unfortunately,
I don't have a torque wrench that fits these.
Right. Did you consider buying like their adapter?
Yes, I probably will, because I've just been kind of doing it good enough, which isn't the right thing to do.
I interrupted you because I was just looking at this, but you've got a hole punch now, and you're just.
Yeah, I'm just hole punching masking tape.
That's jerks.
Quarter inch holes, chuck it over the front of the tool. And you know what? It works really well. Actually thinking about like having some like really thin steel shim stock laser cut to that same kind of shape, and then just super gluing it to the face of my nuts.
Did you say glue it?
So that, yeah, just put like a little dab of super glue or something on there.
Sure.
To glue it to the face of the collet nut. And then that way, again, I have that like seal. I did actually have a rep from a local tooling supplier that I think you know of. I'm not going to name them. I called them up, you know, and they were very responsive. They had a rep at my shop within 3 hours with, you know, catalogs and some sample tools and stuff. Basically, there are some ER systems that have a sealing disc at the front. It's designed for sealing coolant in, but it would also do a very good job of keeping chips out.
Okay.
So yeah, I wanted to get some pricing on that. Funny thing is, I never actually ended up being able to get pricing out of the guy on this system. He basically talked me out of it because he was like, look, the coolant sealing discs are an extra quarter inch thick. So you're still going to have that extra tool stick out, which is the thing that I'm trying to get rid of.
Right. Anyway. Right.
Right. So I was like, okay, yeah, I get it. And so he was trying to like get me into a bunch of other systems. He's trying to get me into shrink fit.
The Rego
trying to get
fix. Me into the,
yeah. The, I think it was the Rego fix, the power grip system.
Yeah. Have you seen that? That's pretty sick. Yeah.
Yeah. But do you know what the entry price is on that?
I do not.
I was like, okay, I mean, yeah, Power Grip looks amazing. How much? And he's like,
$30,000. What is it? Apparently, because you need that machine.
Yeah. So, for those that haven't seen it, the Power Grip, you basically have a tool holder that has like a smooth cone on the inside, kind of like an ER collet holder, and then you have these collets that are very, very close tolerance inside, kind of like an ML holder, and the collet is also just a solid thing. It has no slots or anything in it, and it's just a taper. And you basically just smush these two parts together with a hydraulic power system, mm-hmm. and you smush them so hard that the taper it collapses the inside bore. Like, it actually crushes the steel a little bit and holds onto the shank of the tool that way.
Yeah.
So it's very cool because there's, like, you know, no moving parts.
Almost like heat shrink, but like...
Yeah.
By Without force. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, apparently it's like, I mean, he didn't give me a quote, but he was like, oh yeah, it's like 30K, you know? So I wasn't trying to talk me into it after that. He did also tell me about this Japanese company that are making heat shrink holders, and they're making them out of a material that has it's a type of steel that's been specifically designed to have the largest possible, thermal coefficient of expansion. So when you heat it up, it moves a lot more than regular steel. And that means you can just use a torch. You don't need the like fancy induction heater and stuff. You can just use like a torch or like a really hot heat gun.
Well, I guess a lot of people use a torch anyways, but it must take a while.
I don't think it actually takes that long if you're using like a map torch or something, like a hot torch.
Yeah.
For me,
this would be a lot faster than that.
Yeah, and you're not really supposed to use torches with shrink fit holders. Like, the suppliers tell you not to do it. you know, I think basically it's like the heating has to be even from side to side. And if it's not, then you could potentially be clamping off center or have like uneven clamping pressure. Mm-hmm. I don't know how true that is, but, you know, they want to sell you the $10,000 induction machine or however much that is. So yeah, it was just really interesting having a tooling rep into the shop. I think the cheapest system that he tried to sell me on was about $600 per holder.
Per holder.
Yeah. When he was like, "Where are you getting your tooling from now?" And I said Maritool, and he was like, "Oh, yeah, you know, kind of like dismissing Maritool." But then I was like, "Man, I just go on their website. I'm like, this is what I want. I click order, and it gets here in like 2 days." Like,
well, it's funny because, you know, that tool holder might be $600, but it might not be any better. It's just that they've got a distribution system that everyone's got to get a taste. So the price jumps up to $600 real quick. Because, you know, I've noticed, like, if I've been looking for ER tool holders since Mari Tool doesn't make the one that I want anymore.
Oh, you want that 2.5-inch gauge length one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I would take another gauge length, but their offerings with ER25 is slim now.
Mm. Interesting.
So I've been trying to get pricing on other things, and everything is like $160 or more for what MariTool is selling for $108.
Right. And where are the other tool holders made?
Well, so there's the ones I got from Kenna Metal, which are fine. They're made in Slovenia. And I've heard that I've heard other people have had great success with them.
Right.
They, I don't notice a difference.
Right.
They're 100, like I got them on sale, like because I had a tooling credit with Kenna Metal.
Right.
So they cost about the same as a MariTool tool holder with that tooling credit. But now my tooling credit's up. So I'd have to pay full price for them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you know, Haas have been, I get like 2 emails a day from Haas about Haas tooling.
Yeah. They are going. In Canada yet?
So in Canada, we can apparently order it through our local HFO.
Right. Yeah, that's what Fabrizio.
So if you call Fabrizio, yeah, he'll order it in for you. So I don't know how much extra cost that's going to add or whatever. But honestly, so like their indexable holders and indexable inserts are all made in South Korea, which is a lot of stuff, like a lot of indexable stuff comes from there anyway.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and so I mean, that, a lot that's of not
nice machines are made in South Korea too. Doosans, yes, are all South Korea too, aren't they?
Yep. I think so. Yeah. So I don't hold that as a strike against them. The thing that bothers me is that their tool holders, like the ER collet holders and stuff, are all made in China.
Yeah. How do you know that?
Because it just says on their website.
Oh, it does.
Yeah. Yeah. So they're not really trying to hide it, but it does bother me that they didn't just set up US manufacturing for it.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
But that being said, if they have the gauge length that you want, honestly, just go through the HFO and get it from them because their prices are stupid.
I'm going to check what their prices are.
Their prices are really, it's crazy. I think it's like for an ER25 holder, I think it's like $80 or something.
CT40 ER25, $63.
Yeah,
for a 2.5-inch gauge length.
Yeah, so yeah, Haas are really being really aggressive about getting into that market.
It's it's a good business to be in. Anything
100%,
especially because they're selling tools. You'd be like, I see you need 30 tool holders.
Yeah, you know, and. Absolutely. It makes a ton of sense for them because people are going to trust them. They're a machine tool manufacturer. You know, if you had an issue with a Haas tool holder in your Haas machine, you know, you're going to have a lot more kind of.
Well, that's why they force you. Yeah. Right? That's why they force you to buy their pull studs.
Right. Right. Exactly. So, yeah, if they have what you need, I would get it from Haas. As I said, my issue is just that I hope that they decide to move towards setting up US manufacturing for their tool holders. I understand why they wouldn't do it for inserts and stuff. You know, and as I said, like I'm not miffed that they made in South Korea, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, country of origin, China. I mean,
yeah.
Like
you can have fantastic quality stuff made in China. The issue is just that, you know, China has been very aggressive in the past with subsidizing things like their internal steel industry. So like part of the reason that steel industry in other countries went away is because for a long time, the Chinese government was like subsidizing the cost of steel production in China to the tune of like almost 50%. Wow. So they were like basically pushing everybody else out of the market. You know, so yeah, just stuff like that kind of rubs me the wrong way. Plus, you know, keeping jobs local is a good thing.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to manufacturing China. I mean, it's a massive hub for manufacturing. Yes. I do think having industry in North America is a good thing. And this does seem like, you know, like they're not outsourcing their machines. But they are probably, maybe they're cast. I bet you their castings are from China. That wouldn't surprise me.
No, I have no idea. I think they have it there in foundry. Actually. Did they? Yeah, in California. But, you know, like I think that the way that Frank at Maritool has approached that whole business makes a ton of sense. You know, he's able to compete with tool holders made in other countries that are, you know, have cheaper labor because he's cut out distribution.
Exactly.
So he's, you know, he's maximizing his margins because he's cutting out stuff that doesn't add value. Yeah. I really approve of that.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm super happy with the experience I had. Ordering them was so easy. I'm just I'm sure they have their reasons, but I'm annoyed because I chose ER25 because you told me to. Mm-hmm. and I like the 2.5-inch gauge length. And then now, poof, no more ER25, 2.5-inch. Now they only have.
Did you
call them? I haven't yet. So now honestly, they only have in that, unless you're with
1.85 and 3, right?
Not even 1.85. That would have been nice. Just 3.5 for ER25, unless you get the mini nut, and then you can get 3 or 4 inch.
Oh, that's very
so
strange.
pretty big, pretty long tool holders.
Oh, that's very strange. They've always had the. I hope they haven't actually cut out the 1.85 because that's my favorite tool holder. I have a lot of them.
Yeah, hey, call Frank. He's your guy.
There you go. Oh, yeah. You know, it may just be that they're out of stock or something. So just call them up and ask them what the deal is, you know?
Well, usually they still have it on their website and they just say, check stock. Yeah. Call to check stock. So, and this has been a while. I've been, you know, wanting to buy new tool holders for a couple weeks.
Well, maybe you have to go to ER32. They have ER32 and 2.35.
Yeah, well, I thought about it because I still have some ER32 collets. Because that's what, right. Funny enough, that's what the axes. All my tool holders are your ER32.
Which is such overkill for that little rapid.
So I thought about doing that. It just pisses me off because I bought the 99.
Yeah, you had tried to standardize.
Yeah, and I tried, and now I got to spend $60 on another torque wrench adapter.
Okay, so if you want to go, if you want a cheap experience, if you go to Shaw's, they sell packs of 4 ER25 tool holders, 2.5-inch gauge length, for like $160.
Okay. And where are those made? China?
I think they're made in China as well, yeah.
What about Technics? Are they all right? I mean, all my collets are Technics.
Yeah, I haven't heard bad stuff about them. I think they make their tools in a lot of different places.
Right. Kind of like Kennametal. I was, you know, like they're not Kennametal. It's not even branded Kennametal. It's branded something else. Ericsson.
Oh, really? Oh, okay.
But they're fine. They're nice. The one thing that I think is funny about them, and this is probably, you know, I'm not a machinist, but they are hand deburred. Around the what is it called, the anti rotation tabs,
right? Yeah, the slots.
Yeah, the slots.
Drive slots is what they
drive slot. Yeah, so they're clearly handy bird. That's just like ugly, this little like chamfer, which, you know, is probably just a result of them, you know, doing this on just probably a big old lathe without like the fancy multi-axis live tooling, whatever.
So I'm just on the Shaw's website, and you know what's crazy? So it's not $150, it's $260 for a pack of 4, which means that buying from Haas would be cheaper.
Wow.
That's pretty nuts.
Well, I mean, that's what you get. I mean, overseas made stuff, like made in China, is cheap.
Yeah.
often.
Yeah. You know, I don't advocate buying the cheapest thing. I don't think that that's a good thing to do. But, you know, it's interesting. Like, we want to keep manufacturing local. And to do that, part of what we have to do is continue to exist as manufacturers and, you know, in your case, as an employer. You know, so if there's no difference to you between buying a $600 tool holder or buying a $60 tool holder, then, you know, kind of buy the 60.
Yeah, well, if they are within the tolerances they're stating, then
yep,
they'll be just fine for me. I liked the idea of supporting MariTool, and I liked the experience I got from them because it was so easy.
Mm-hmm.
They did make me addicted to that price point. And now when I look at a different, you know, quality tool, tooling manufacturer, but it's $40, $50, $60, $100+ more. That's a harder pill to swallow now because I'm used yeah. to the price that they've got me used to. I'm hooked on that price point.
Well, and I agree with you, particularly when we're talking about another tool manufacturer that has distributors. You know, so if you're like buying from like a retail location or through a distributor and it's, you know, a $300 tool holder, as you said, like a distributor is not going to take less than like at least 25%, usually more like 50, you know, so much of that price is just going to a place that isn't really giving you any benefit other than, you know, so this tooling manufacturer, this tooling distributor that I was talking to, they don't even hold stock.
Right. Yeah.
So if I order something, they're just going to have it drop shipped from the manufacturer, you know? So really there's no reason why the manufacturer shouldn't just make a website like MariTool and sell direct, you know, like,
I recently, or yesterday, I put in an order with Triumph Tools for some Harvey and Helical tooling, which I'm really excited right. about. I had to literally call them, and I talked to a lovely woman, and she was super friendly and was extremely eager to help. And I had to read out the tool numbers,
right?
Like the SKU number to her. And she manually entered them and then sent me an email with a quote. And then, of course, when I'm reading the quote, the tool listing, they give like, you know, they use jargon, like everything short form. So I'm like, in order to reference check this versus the website, like I've got to do some sort of make some assumptions. You know, it's like, it's not listed in the quote like it's listed on the website.
Right.
So it's kind of annoying.
Okay. So maybe you don't know this. Harvey, if you go on the Harvey Tool website and you go through and add stuff to your cart.
Yeah, you can share it.
Yeah, you send it to the distributor, and then
so I called them though, and that's this is I told her, I said I have it all in my cart. She was like, yeah, just read them out to me. And I was like, I can share this, anyways.
Right.
That's my first time.
Yeah, I agree. It's
so. But I asked her. I was like, I also need some ER tool holders, which you know would be a different supplier. So. Right. She was like, well, I can put you in touch with our salespeople and they can talk you through it. And, you know, it's like if I need a shell mill holder or I need a deburring, I needed that crazy deburring tool or that we were talking about,
right.
Like they are sort of a one-stop source for this stuff. And then it's free shipping. If I order anything over $300, they're making sure I'm not having to, I mean, I'm paying tax on it.
But you're not going to be paying brokerage.
I'm not going to be paying brokerage. And with MariTool, I don't think that they were putting I think I paid duty on it because they didn't provide a USMCA certificate of origin, which they could.
Oh. Well, so I don't know how long it's been since you've done a MariTool order, but in Canada now, if you ask them to ship with FedEx, they will charge you Canadian HST up front. Like they will clear it for you and then send it with FedEx. So there's no like further.
Well, the funny thing is all they'd have to do is fill out a USMCA document. And unless there's something for some reason they don't qualify, but it's an American made product, it would definitely be within the criterion of, the manufacturing requirements. So it's like 70% made It's 100% made in the U.S. of materials consisting of materials sourced in or outside of the U.S., which would put them into criterion B, I think. So it would be, it would qualify for no import taxes. And that's how I ship my guitars. So people in the States or Mexico don't have to pay tax. I'm sure lots of, like, obviously tons of people take advantage of free trade, but never in the small scale sense. It's like, you know, if I order pickups, you know, like, they're not filling these documents out. It's really easy to do.
Well, so yes, free trade is good, but marital stuff is made in the States.
Yeah.
But that means you still have to pay HST on it. You're not paying duty. You're still paying HST.
Who's collecting it?
The, good question. I think it just goes straight to the government.
Well, but you're not, who are you paying it to? You're not. You pay duty. But if it's free trade, you don't pay it. That's kind of the point. Mm. You're not paying tax on it. Now, we would get our tax back as a business. We could get to write that off or whatever. But you still got to pay it up front.
I have a friend that is actually a Canadian Border Services officer. I'll ask him about that. I'm pretty sure that you have to pay HST.
You have to pay it at the border? You have to pay it separately? Like, you have to remember to pay this later when you pay your taxes? Because if I ship something, if I ship a guitar to an American and I use this document, they do not pay duty.
If I Americans pay duties on taxes, I guess, on much.
If I imported pickups from Lawler, a pickup manufacturer, and I've asked them to do this in the past, to provide the document, or I've provided it for them, and then I import it, FedEx, UPS, DHL, they don't call me and say, "Hey, you owe $360 on this now." You go, "Oh, it clears customs without a duty charge." And then maybe I'm supposed to call up the Canadian government at the end and say, "Hey, I bought these and now I owe HST on them," but I don't think that's how it works. So, anyways, I don't have a thorough understanding of it. All I know is when I ship something, I fill this document out, and that's kind of the point of free trade.
Yeah, that's true.
If somebody listening knows, please.
Well, as I said, I have a friend who is a literally he's a commercial import inspection officer with the Canadian Border Services Agency.
Yeah, so text him.
I will ask him.
Okay.
Yeah,
he
has some crazy stories about like, there was a guy, they got a big wooden crate and they look at the bill of lading, and they're like, this thing's full of snakes. And then, you know, the guy comes to pick it up and they're like, are any of these snakes venomous? Or sorry, the guy said, "Are any of these snakes poisonous?"
Okay.
And the customs agent says, "Are any of these snakes poisonous?" And the guy that's picking them up says, no, none of them are poisonous. And then so the customs officer is looking up. He's like, "Okay, what are the names of them?" So he's looking it up and he's like, "It says here this one's poisonous." And the guy's like, "No, it's not poisonous. It's venomous."
Nice.
Poisonous is when you eat it. Venomous is when they bite you. Yeah, and he was not gonna, because apparently it's like a whole other thing, you know, if you're importing like venomous animals. And
does he get to keep the snakes?
I don't know what the end of that but they deal with a lot of that kind of stuff, you know.
I know. I
pull the wool over your eyes.
I've tried to really dial in our shipping stuff, and like, I always feel like I'm shipping like a pound of cocaine every time I ship a guitar, just because I'm like, I feel like they're going to scrutinize the shit out of it, because like, it's expensive and it's wood and it's got electronic components, But really, it's like probably the most innocuous thing they're seeing cross the border that day. Yeah. So
by far the most annoying thing that's happened to me with shipping was, I forget what the issue was. I think a customer got like the wrong color or something. You know, I don't have that happen often, but it does happen. Sure. He returned the knife to me. I asked him to mark it a certain way, and either his post office wouldn't let him do that, or he did it incorrectly. I forget which one it was. I ended up getting charged import duties on my own knife.
Right.
It was being returned to me, and then it got stolen out of the box. So I got an empty package delivered back to me that I had paid duties on. And then, yeah, it was just like, and then I had to do an insurance claim. Yeah, it was crazy.
Oh my God. So annoying.
Very silly.
Yeah. No, shipping's crazy.
That's the thing. You know, a lot of people that are starting a small business don't even realize that like something like that's going to be a problem. You know, like you just sense stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think, but like for us, because of the value of it, we can't use Canada Post, which would be an easy way to ship. It's an easy, cheap way to ship something, but that you're not technically allowed to ship anything valued over $2,500 through Canada Post. So then, it's the minute you start using one of the other shippers, now it's a commercial shipment. Well, I guess you have to claim it as a commercial shipment with Canada Post, but it's just less complicated. Now you've got like all this documentation to fill out, and then it hits customs, and they, you know, for us, they were like, the first time we ship something, they're like, where's your USDA plant and plant product declaration? Like, I didn't know we needed one. Where's your this has finish on it? Like, where's your chemical compliance documentation or whatever? What it's called, but and then they kept getting stopped at the border, and we're like, what the fuck do they keep getting stopped? Because mother of pearl. They're like, oh, you can't export mother of pearl into the States unless the person has a fish and wildlife permit.
Right, so it's not actually mother of pearl, right? It's you were using.
Well, we were using mother of pearl.
Oh, okay, right.
Now we'll use like pearloid. We still use mother of pearl for Canadians and Europeans. You just can't ship it to the States.
Yeah, it's funny. I get people from the States all the time being like, oh, why can't you use tritium in your knives instead of the glow in the dark? Because tritium would just glow forever because it's a radioactive gas in a vial. And I'm like, well, because it's illegal. You can't send it in the post to anywhere. And even owning it in Canada is illegal unless unless it's in like a certified emergency lighting, like emergency signage. And even then they're like trying to phase it out because it's radioactive.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
So anyways, there's just complications like that, but yeah. So we do a USMCA, certificate of origin, and then our customers in the States pay no duty, DHL, no brokerage.
I just put on mine. Where's it from? Canada, Ontario.
Yeah.
Done.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Yeah, because you ship Canada Post?
No, I ship with DHL.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, I think
you could do a commercial invoice?
No. Yes, I do a commercial invoice, and it says this country of origin and the HS code on there, but that's all I have to do.
There's a certain price point that seems to be scrutinized much more by customs. And
it's
package.
Over $500 US. Yeah. Then underneath that, you don't need like a detailed invoice. And over that, you need detailed invoice and blah, blah, blah.
So I've got the system dialed in. You know, they still get held up in customs every once in a while. It's usually because DHL didn't submit the documentation at all. Mm. Like they submitted the commercial invoice, but they missed the four other documents that I create. And anytime we ship to the UK or anywhere like outside of North America, I have to do a SIRS report. So I have to log into like a Canada government website, the CBSA website, and
oh wow,
like create a claim that I'm shipping something.
Oh, wow.
It's a whole other thing. It's pretty easy to do, but it's a pain still. anything extra. So, but yeah, we've been getting guitars shipped out, and it's been good. they've been arriving.
That's good. Wow, we went full circle this time. We've gone all over the place.
Yeah. Do you have anything else you want to ramble on about?
No, not today. I mean, you and I are just catching up because we haven't spoken in a while, so we're kind of focusing on that. I think hopefully by our next recording, we'll have some space stuff to talk about.
Yeah.
There was actually a tour that you would probably like. There's a space company called Firefly Aerospace that are making kind of small-scale rockets.
Cool.
And Tim Dodd, the everyday astronaut, did, I think it's like an hour and 15 minutes tour through their manufacturing facility. And do got to cool see machines? A... yeah, they've got like a bunch of DMG five-axis machines, the spaceship-looking ones.
Oh, yeah.
You know, some nice live-tooled lathes and that kind of stuff.
I just pulled up the YouTube video.
I think the craziest room is actually there. They have a clean room specifically designed for doing composite, like carbon fiber composite layouts, including this like laser projection system. So they have like integrated with their CAD system. They actually have like, they have like a CNC cutting table that cuts the pre-impregnated carbon fiber out of rolls. Okay. And then for each piece, they have like a laser projector that projects the outline of that piece of carbon fiber onto the mold to show you where to place it.
Oh, yeah, that's do wicked. Layups. Kind of like tracing.
Yeah, so that's super cool. Yeah, but the clean room for doing their carbon fiber layups is like 2,500 square feet.
Oh, sick.
It's huge, yeah. And at the end of it, you get to see they actually do a test, like a static fire of one of their rockets. And Tim and the camera, they're like 200 meters away from this rocket being fired.
Fuck yeah.
Very, very cool. Yeah.
All right.
So yeah, if you want to see some space manufacturing, yeah, Firefly Aerospace on YouTube. And then, yeah, hopefully by next week, there'll be some more SpaceX static fires of Starship. And maybe getting into an orbital test launch, actually.
Cool.
But yes, on a personal level, not too much. Hopefully tomorrow I'll get the get Millie back up and running, get my shop back into a working state.
Yeah, I'll be. I'm on pins and needles.
Sounds good. Yeah, I've been talking to some machine reps and stuff, which we'll have to talk about next.
Excuse me? As well. That's how you're going to leave us hanging?
Yeah.
You son of a bitch.
Yeah. It's been an interesting experience, actually.
Well, because you're, you know, are you just sick of having your machines be in repair?
Blow up. No, you know what? Honestly, I was thinking about that. Someone asked me about that, actually. You know, they're like, oh, you seem to spend more time fixing your machines than you do making knives. And I'm like, that's not even close to being true. But, you know, in the last, like, 2 years, 3 years, I've spent maybe $1,000 on Millie, maybe $600, $800 in parts. Just, you know, and like, a couple of days of downtime. That's not even one payment, one monthly payment on a new machine.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, it would have to be, it would have to improve your process and make it more efficient.
Yes.
To justify.
100%.
Give you a route to being more creative. Something like that. You know, it's like if you got a five-axis machine, well, what could you do with that? Like, you could be more creative. So, you know, so it's like I think they're those things that you have to sort of – it's a good way to weigh how good a purchase something would be.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to be a big value add in some way for sure.
Yeah.
And I think, the you know, the next thing that I'm going to be chasing down is just like the quality of my surface finishes.
Yeah.
So I've been doing like a lot of experimentation with Fusion 360, trying to like squeeze every little bit of out of it.
Well, the cool thing about that is, sorry to interrupt, but I was just going to say, like, when you do get that new machine eventually, when you've got plug that into with that experience in a Makino F5 or something, you know, like,
well, yeah, I mean, we can talk about it briefly, but it's very interesting. Like, there, I didn't realize this, but there's apparently like a whole other section of the CAD industry just focused around surface finish for tool and die applications.
Yeah, I believe.
And I did actually get a quick, you know, verbal quote for one of these software packages. So this isn't CAD. It's just CAM.
Okay.
And it's just designed for surfacing. And it's $25,000 US per seat.
Per seat? Like per person that can use it?
Yeah.
Is that is it software that you buy and download, or is that a yearly subscription?
They do have like a maintenance fee if you want to pay it to get like the latest updates. But yeah, you just get to keep it. You know, and in the right application, like if you're like able to reduce hand finishing or whatever,
it sure, totally $25,000 can become cheap real quick.
Yeah. But for me, you know, I'm trying to work out, is the limitation my machines or is it my CAD? And I'm pretty sure it's my machines. You know, so, but I've been going through this process of like trying to work out, there are some actually pretty non-intuitive settings in Fusion that significantly impact your surface finishes. So I'm gonna try and do a video on that, just kind of demonstrating the like worst to best. And then it has other impacts as well, right? Like I made some changes in the way that I generate my tool paths because of that, to try and maximize the surface finish. And the time it takes to generate tool paths on my computer went from like, you know, less than a minute to like 25 minutes.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so yeah, it's pretty interesting, all that stuff.
Yeah. I think that's a great way to approach it. Cause again, like if you can get better surface finishes with the machine you have, once you do get a new machine, you'll get exceptional surface finishes by applying those same principles. Plus you know, a better machine.
So yeah, I'll leave you on that cliffhanger. I'll make some notes to make sure I don't remember this. I don't forget this stuff for next time we talk. But yeah, it's good to be back in the saddle. It's good to be catching up with you again. And we're going to catch up every 2 weeks, I think.
I think that's easier. I think that's that'll be easier to be consistent with. And
yes.
And not.
And I think we'll also have more to talk about. Little while, I think we've been running a little lean, you know. I think it will be better to have a bit more stuff to talk about.
Yeah, we'll maybe be a little more refreshed.
Yeah, 100%. So lovely catching up with you as always, Nick. Lovely to speak to everyone that's listening. You can stop being angry with us now. And we will talk to you all again in 2 weeks.
Right on.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.